Madam, I've hauled the mechanical gypsy down from the attic, as you've requested.
Thank you, Mr. Darling. How do you like her?
I must say, she's more lifelike than I expected her to be. When the demons lifted the cover off her case, she gave me quite a fright. Where do you want her plugged in?
Oh, she's, automatic, darling. No electricity is needed for her.
But there are lights and little mice poised to play violins and a coin slot.
That's just there to fool the guests, darling.
Of course. Can you help me get my money back?
Of course. Welcome back to the Midnight Library, everyone. Oh, it is so nice to see the foyer fill with victims. I mean, visitors. Now, I know that some of you are waiting for your chance to have your fortune told by our glass case gypsy, Maria, but there'll be plenty of time to interact with her after the reading. So, if I could coax you to your seats in the reading room, please? Oh, and I insist that you help yourself to some harmless tea and biscuits as you make your way to your chosen spot. Oh, there we are. That's better. So good to see you all. I am your wholesome hostess, Miranda Merrick. Everyone comfy? No? Wonderful. Let me begin by saying that I knew when I asked Mr. Darling and his helpers to bring Maria down from the attic of the library that she would gather a crowd. Isn't she bewitching? She's been in my family for, well, a few centuries now, at least. And I thought, given the topic of this evening's reading, that this was the perfect time to showcase her unusual talents. You'd probably like to know that she was made as a kind of hobby project by a several times great-great kind of grandfather of mine, who was supposedly from Romania, and his name sounded like Pricolici, or something or other. The ink is sometimes blurry in our family record books, you know. Anyway, she's been moved around through various countries and handed down or gifted laterally to different branches of my family across time. And happily, she resides here with us currently. There's a fragile diary of her meandering travels and many predictions, both mundane and extraordinary, on a top shelf in my study. One fascinating entry I've committed to memory, from the year 1762, tells of how her presence aboard a three-masted schooner, the Octavius, was so disturbing to the crew. She was apparently malfunctioning for days and kept prattling on and on about the ship being cursed and the crew being doomed, even declaring how every living soul was to be lost, then imploring them to reroute and replot a new course to save themselves from their damned fate. Well, the men became so angst-ridden and rattled by her impassioned pleas that they, along with the willing help of their captain, Henrik Vanderhul, carried her above deck and hoisted her over the side of the wooden vessel, and then dropped her from a great height. Some applauded as her glass case splashed into the open ocean and then slipped beneath the waves of the frigid waters of the Bering Sea. The Octavius then set sail on its planned course to find its way home to England by navigating the treacherous Northwest Passage in the Arctic Circle. Maria was found, safe and soundly sealed inside her windowed cabinet, exactly 1 year later, in 1763. She had washed up upon the tropical shores of a small atoll in the vast expanse of the Pacific Ocean. The glint off the glass of her elegant case attracted the attention of a passing ship, the Mystique. A group of sailors were deployed to investigate the glimmering object, and were amazed and overjoyed to have found her on the pale sandy beach, motionless and beautiful in her gleaming armoire. The diary of her travels, entangled in some seaweed, dangled from a finial from the top of the handcrafted case. They regarded her as treasure and a good luck charm, and immediately lifted her to safety aboard their galleon. The Octavius never returned to England, but was found adrift off the coast of Greenland in 1775, 13 years later. But the captain, the entire crew, and a few passengers, 28 people in total, were all on board. They were dead, but on board. The ship was intact, but derelict. Everyone on board had frozen to death years before, and had freeze-dried to their final spots, becoming one with the bones of the boat. For 13 years, the ship was nothing more than a drifting casket of icy corpses. The captain of the Mystique, a man simply known as the Marquis, vowed to return Maria to England after his ship's 4-month trade mission was completed. Some unknown person aboard ship had documented in Maria's diary that the captain had become, quote, extremely fond of Maria, only allowing members of the crew to catch glimpses of her when they were summoned to his private quarters. It was written that on quiet nights, when the waters were calm, she could be heard softly speaking to the Marquis. And whatever she told him on the night of October 13th in 1763, at sunrise, the crew awoke to find the captain had completely changed the course of the ship by himself in the night and had set sail back to England a full month early. Maria was discovered in her sparkling glass case with her diary resting against its oak frame on the dock of a nameless fishing inlet near Penzance, England. Oddly, there are plenty of records documenting the accursed ship, the Octavius, and its captain, Henrik Vanderhul. But there are no records of the Mystique or its captain, the Marquis. Pretty impressive adventure for a woman who never stands on her own feet. But automatons from history have been far more lively in their own actions, as I'll explain. First, a definition. An automaton is said to be a mechanical device or machine made in the image of a human being, designed to follow, act out, or react to a predetermined or programmed set of instructions or sequence of operations. The word is Greek in its origin and means to act of one's own accord, and is a creature similar to or synonymous with the words robot, android, humanoid, automata, and golem. The golem is a befitting place to begin, as they are literally the dusty, time-worn precursors to the more sophisticated mechanized beings they begat. If you've never heard of the golem, you're in for a messy, magical treat. We're likely all familiar with the biblical beginnings of the creation story of the first human being, Adam, who was said to be formed from the very dust of the earth's soil by the hand of God. Respectfully, some believe this is a fact, whilst some believe this to be a myth. Personally, I submit to you that as we all gather the nutrients that create our own bodies from the fruits and vegetation that grow by drawing their components out of the soil of the earth, that this is an ongoing truth at its core idea. even as some consume the flesh of animals who consume the plants that form them, we make ourselves manifest from the organic ingredients of the earth. So perhaps we all have a little something in common with the ancient beings known as the Golem. The word Golem itself is from the Hebrew language and means unfinished or incomplete. Mentioned only once in the Bible, but more extensively in the Talmud, golems were anthropomorphic or human-like beings made by Jewish rabbis or mystics from mud or clay that could be brought to life by ritual magic. And who among us doesn't like the sound of that? Briefly, a Jewish holy man could form with his hands a wee doll-like being from dust, mud, clay, and perhaps wax. Any of us could do this if we were so inclined, I suppose. But the next bit truly is key and where our talents would be found to be lacking without doubt. Holy scripts directed that the maker of the golem should be a blameless person without sin, who lived closely to God. I'm guessing this is the qualification that may cut more than a few of our chances down to nil. But after forming the dirt doll, a holy priest was said to go about a number of mystical prayer-induced steps that would bring the new golem to life. He would dance a prayer dance around the mud doll, then write on a piece of paper or carve into the forehead of the new being the name of God, or the word Emet, which means truth. Some writings state that the magic words would be written on paper and placed inside the mouth of the little mud man. This ritual would bring the new golem to life. And I hear you thinking, wonderful. Now what? Well, a golem was then at the priest's beck and call. It could grow perhaps to 11 feet, become strong, and could do cumbersome work. It could toil in the fields and lift several times over what a human could, and was even said to defend the Jewish people during times of conflict. Interestingly, golems, these powerful mud slaves, could not speak. There are stories of golems who became unruly and a danger to the people around them. When this happened, the priest would simply remove God's name from its forehead, or withdraw the scripted paper from its mud mouth, or even change the word Emet to the word Met, meaning death, and the mud being would abruptly stop. The golem, then, was no longer alive, and so would crumble to dust. Charming. Speaking of charming, our sponsor for tonight's reading in the Midnight Library is brought to you by Grimm's Grocers. Grimm's has the standard goods like every grocery store. Eggs and bread and meat and cheese and cereal galore. They also deal in rare goods the other shops ignore. Dark things, secret things, supernatural, you know. Magic things and daring things, more mystic apropos. Beyond the shelves of dry goods, past the frozen pizza aisle, they keep the weirdo sly goods, the ghoulish things with style. A cape, a broom, some nightshade, some demon chow for your crew. The back room is for secret trade. If anyone asks, just say you never knew. Grimm's Grocers at the corner of Vincent and Price. Tonight's complimentary tea, dear guests, is provided by Grimm's Grocers and is a fine blend of Dewdrop of Hemlock and fly agaric nodules. It's called Nightmare in a Cup. Now, I want to proceed by telling you briefly about a few of the first known automatons, and then I want to unleash a... let's say, unravel a lively tale of one of the world's most cunningly clever and enigmatic mechanoids. In mythology, we have writings of handmade beings of mud and wood. Even incredulous stories like that of the giant bronze automaton Talos from Greece, who was said to protect the islands from pirates. These first rumored beings were often endowed with the power of motion by way of magic or infused with spirit. Even alchemy was alleged, and mysterious substances such as quicksilver or mercury were credited with the power to make the creations mock true life. But later, we begin to read of more complexly built, smartly designed, purpose-driven beings, formed in the likenesses of rabbits that hopped, birds that flitted about or even chirped, and of course, animated imitation people. As you might deduce, kings from the earliest records denoting such things were the first to be gifted with the famed mechanical beings, which were crafted by their talented court of servants, wizards, inventors, and craftsmen. The wise king, Solomon, was written to have designed his own amazing mechanical animal servants that literally sprung into action to escort and exalt him upon his throne. Attended by automated golden lions and oxen, and some manner of, one might guess, wind-up doves that presented him with his holy scrolls. Even infamous artist and inventor Leonardo da Vinci was written to have designed and built as many as 3 mechanical lions that walked, sat, and presented flowers at the feet of royalty. But, alas, no physical piece of the lions or their preliminary drawings remain. These first clever inventions were often powered by water being poured through them. The pressure driving wooden wheels, levers, and pulleys that would in turn lift the automaton's arms, blink its eyes, or nod or shake its head to give a yes or no answer in response to a person's questions. Tell me, mechanical mystic, will my poison kill the king?
An affirmative nod, yes! Huzzah!
But the literal game changer was devised in 1770 by a Hungarian author and inventor, Baron Wolfgang von Kempelen. I want to tell you of how this singular creation changed history in ways that benefit us still today, in spite of its, let's say, shifty design. It also kept company with some of the most noted names in history during its life. 1770. It was in this year that von Kempelen presented the Mechanical Turk, a life-size seated figure that could play the game of chess. It was not only astonishing in this rare ability, as the mechanized man could actually move his wooden hands to grasp and accurately place the small chess pieces precisely on the board. The Turk was an exotic, mystical beauty to see, made to present as a strange visitor from a far-off land. The fine wood from which he was carved gave him a swarthy complexion. A thick, dark mustache festooned his handsome face, complemented his smoky gray eyes, and an impressive woven turban sat atop his lifelike head. He was dressed in the striking, curious clothes of the Eastern Ottoman style, with a billowy tunic and gold brocaded vest of brilliantly colored silk. And the Turk just wasn't for show in his riveting appearance and his incredible ability to move a few game pieces around. He could actually engage in a match of the game of chess. And any of you who plays chess may know just what an astounding achievement that is. Chess is not called the sport of kings as a casual expression. It's a complex game of an almost endless possible combination of moves that require the abilities of deep thought, concentration, visualization, the capacity to comprehend the theoretical outcome of your own moves, and the multitude of possible moves they may prompt from your opponent. And not just in a single move, but many, many moves in the future. The ability of mastering the game of chess is thought to be a solid indication of high intelligence, a person or a king's ability to plan, protect, to lead, and if needed, to win a war. Playing the game of chess to the point of victory requires elite and lofty intelligence in humans, and yet this wooden doll machine almost always won. The Turk sat upright at his sizable game table, which housed the intricate turning gears, moving rods, and rising weights and cranking levers that imbued motion to his steady arms and graceful gripping fingers. To be clear, this incomprehensible machine came at a time when people were still heating their homes and even palaces with fire, and lighting dim rooms with candles and oil-filled lamps. So you can imagine the confounding disbelief that those who were first presented with the Mechanical Turk must have experienced. And you must be wondering, what in the world caused this man, Compellan, to even conceive of such a thing, and to go so far as to create it? Well, he did it to impress a woman, and given who she was, it was going to take something of this caliber to attract her attention. She was Mary Teresa, the Queen of Hungary and Bulgaria. She was also the Archduchess of Austria, and the only female sovereign of the royal Habsburg family lineage. Although, unlike her closely knit... That's too nondescript. Inbred. Unlike her famously inbred family members, Mary Teresa was a fine beauty and did not inherit the notorious protruding lower jaw and severe underbite, so distinctive of many of her royal relatives. Sometime earlier, von Compellan was present at court to witness the stage work of famed illusionist François Pelletier, who caused most of his magic to work, the seemingly self-willed moving of inanimate objects that floated and defied gravity with the use of strong magnets. When von Compellan saw how enthralled and entertained the beautiful queen was, he vowed to return to court with an even more magical creation. He kept his word. When the Turk was brought before her in her imperial court, Queen Mary was provided an up-close and intimate inspection of the automata and his magnificent cabinet of wondrous workings. Before the first game of chess was played before the monarch and a milling throng of courtesans, the Turk's cabinet doors were forthrightly opened for the Queen and everyone present to witness the strategic scheme of wheels and pulleys, cogs and pegs and pinions of the inner workings of the enigmatic mechanical man. The cabinet doors were then closed, and a worthy opponent was chosen to try his hand and mind against the skills of the Mechanical Turk. As a courtesy and a matter of moral integrity, a member of the royal court was selected. He was none other than the minister to the queen, Ludwig von Cabenzl, a dignified gentleman in a powdered wig and a high-collared waistcoat. Then, the most intently watched game ensued, and lasted only 30 minutes. The Turk won, of course, and became an immediate sensation. Time after time, to the sound of whirring gears and squeaking springs, and the striking characteristic of a little curl of white smoke that arose from his distinguished turban. The Turk would appear to study the chessboard, nod knowingly to the crowd of onlookers, and methodically hold his challengers in check. For the next few months, the routine as the mechanized man held court was always the same. The Turk was delivered to his stage, lifted and positioned by the same group of men. His creator, Compellan, serving as proud presenter, would piously and ceremoniously open the mechanoid's desk compartments one by one and invite onlookers to peer within, even holding a candle to light the insides that bore the intricate rotating workings. The Turk would then ease into motion in the same manner for every match he engaged in, always representing the white side, always having the first move, and adroitly dispatching chess opponent after chess opponent before the staring eyes of the hushed crowds, who would then burst into joyous applause to punctuate each of his silent, glorious victories. Compellan received invitations across Europe to display his invention in many venues, but he had already begun refusing more appearances in his own country, explaining that the Turk was broken and that he was having difficulties getting the right components to make the necessary repairs. In fact, over the next 10 years, the Turk was only functional enough to take on the playing challenge of only a single opponent before an audience. He won that solitary match and afterwards was completely dismantled by his creator, Compellan, who was content with the brief few months of stardom and impressing the queen. He wanted no more of the spotlight and refused to hear anything more about it from anyone. Anyone except the queen's son, now the Holy Roman Emperor Joseph II, who ordered him to reassemble the charming chess bot and to have it up and running and all polished up in time to entertain a royal visitor, the Grand Duke Paul Alexandrovich of Russia. The Duke was entranced by the mystical chess-playing man, and this helped solidify diplomatic relations between the two countries. And that performance was such a resounding success, Compellan felt confident enough to accept his earlier invitations, and thus began the grand tour of the Turk across Europe. For months, Compellan and his crew of robot roadies stayed in some of the most luxurious hotels in various countries in Europe. And the Turk dished out game after game, winning nearly every single game before crowds of wonder-filled onlookers. In France, the Turk took on one of his most noted opponents who happened to be there representing the United States as ambassador, Mr. Benjamin Franklin, whom the Turk handily bested as he sat opposite the mechanical man before a swarm of spectators. The tour was a fantastic success that made Compellan a well-known and wealthy man. When he returned, the Turk was retired and given a place of honor and sat as a display in the spot where he made his debut so many years before, in the Schönbrunn Palace in Vienna, Austria. Compellan died at the age of 70 in 1804, and the Turk remained at rest for what most probably assumed was for good, until a man named Johann Mausel made Compellan's son an offer he couldn't refuse, offering him 10,000 francs for the now-defunct mechanoid. This would be roughly $40,000 in today's money, and a very princely sum in 1805. It was believed that von Compellan's son, being the only living person who understood the true method of getting the Turk to work, then handed over the instructions to Mausel, who would become the machine's new showmaster. Mausel, a man known to be a dodgy character at best, did manage to get the Turk going again, even making subtle enhancements and upgrades to the smoothness of its aged under-cabinet workings, and going so far as installing a kind of voice box mechanism that enabled the Turk to gallantly speak one word.
Turk.
When it made its triumphant move, he finally got the automaton back on stage and in winning action. The Turk was even challenged by none other than Napoleon Bonaparte, who tried in typical fashion to take control of the board early on by insisting on playing as the white side. It's recorded that the Turk became agitated by this discourtesy, so much so that he leveled his wooden arm parallel to the board and swept the pieces onto the floor. Uncharacteristically delighted by this rudeness, Napoleon acquiesced, played black, and was shortly defeated in this tabletop battle. Speaking of black, the little dark biscuits on the tray, all jet black with chips of gray, they were purchased for you as a treat with your tea. From Grimm's Grocers, of course, who else would it be? They're delicious but strange and cause a euphoric effect. You'll just love us more as their flavor directs. Grimm's little black biscuits cause a dizzying desire. You'll return to the library, your heart full of fire. Where would we be without Grimm's Grocers to thank? We won't even discuss that tea that you drank. We'll just see you next time, ever eager at our door, and we'll just keep shopping at Grimm's Grocery Store. Grimm's featured item this week is Belinda's Badger Balm. It magically treats everything from demon blisters to broom rash. Trust me, I know. Grimm's Grocers at the corner of Vincent and Price. So, Napoleon was handed his hat by the turban-bedecked Turk, and a few years later, Maelzel set his sights on America to further his fame and fatten his pockets. He booked a cabin on board a ship that would send himself, his Turk, and his crew across the Atlantic and see them alight in the harbor of New York City. The year was 1826, and New York was already the most modern city in the world. Everything new, cutting-edge, and forward-thinking was happening there. New ideas, new food, entertainment, fashion, architecture, advances in medicine, and of course New York was taking part in the Industrial Revolution, the beginning of having machines do the work that humans had always done. This, you may recall from your history lessons at school, was not exactly popular with everyone. People at this time were fearful of being replaced by machines in their workplace, which I'm sure you know is a theme witnessed within humanity over and over again. In any case, for a few years, the Turk drew much attention in New York City. Who wouldn't want to pay a little money to witness a machine that could not only seemingly move of its own volition, but that could also think for itself? This was too amazing. One person who thought so was our dear friend, Mr. Edgar Allan Poe, who was employed as a young reporter for the Southern Messenger. And it was Poe's job to think and report in an analytical fashion on the state-of-the-art happenings of his time. And our Mr. Poe, as many of you know, was not just a brilliant writer, but also a great thinker, bringing forth writing techniques and character types that would advance literature and entertainment well into the future. He also had new ideas about medicine and physics and various inventions, a man well ahead of others in his vast intellect. Poe attended the live stage shows that featured the Turk on several occasions and began to suspect that something was not quite as it seemed in regards to this thinking machine. He became a bit obsessed with discovering just how it might even be possible for this box of gears and pulleys to think, because he believed the answer was simple. It didn't. Poe took it upon himself to investigate. He attended more shows and learned what history he could about the inventor of the machine. He learned how it was sold by the inventor's son, and had even been sold and bought back by its current owner, Mousel. He closely observed the men who handled the now-aged machine, making note of how they moved about it as they prepared it for an exhibition, and what each man's job was when the Turk was being removed after a performance. And sure enough, Poe's eye caught something that all the others had missed by now, thousands of others. He saw that one man didn't seem to have a great deal of the heavy lifting to do. A smaller man with a slight hunch was present doing minor things, perhaps polishing the Turk's gleaming wooden face and setting up the chessboard before every show. And while the other men in the crew could be seen standing in the wings or seated downstage during the hypnotic spectacle, the smaller man could not. He was nowhere to be found. Poe published his discerning findings, and soon others witnessed the same peculiar routine of the humanoid's handyman. Rumors arose, and attendance fell. Mousel quickly and quietly booked a tour for the Turk in a place he knew the scuttlebutt of the day hadn't had time to reach yet. He and his crew, with their wooden robot in tow, headed for the nation state of Cuba. And although this was a sharp idea, this trip proved to be the undoing of the Grand Turk. During the voyage, the curious small man with the bent posture came down with yellow fever and died. He was William Schlumberger, a dignified man who helped with the assemblage of the Turk before each show and the disassemblage of the Turk at the closing of each show. He was also, as you've no doubt concluded, the wizard behind the curtain, or in this case, beneath the desk of the Mechanical Turk, and one of the keenest chess players of his time. He would appear with the other workers as the machine was being set up, and whilst Kempelen was having the cabinet doors opened and shown to the audience. But he would swiftly duck inside a hidden compartment at the back of the cabinet before each chess match began. In fact, the enchanting wafts of smoke that rose from the Turk's stylish turban, giving him the illusion of thinking, was in reality smoke from a candle that Schlumberger would light, allowing him to see inside the darkened enclosure. And I can hear your keen thoughts asking, but what about all the other times? This machine had been around since 1770. Sadly, the foreign-looking beauty and audience-attracting appliance was a fraud from the start. A fraud, yes, but I submit to you that this fraud was anything but a failure, which I'll explain. Yes, the Turk, from the instant of its debut all those years before, was equipped with a concealed chessmaster within its cabinet of impressive workings. As a matter of fact, in order to have made so many enthralling appearances for as many years as it did, and in order to hoodwink not only the common folk, but some of the greatest minds of its era, it required the employ of perhaps as many as a dozen of various chess champions over the length of its cozen career. It is at this point I find myself wanting to come to the defense of the famed fraudulent machine, and by proxy, its deceptive creator, Baron Wolfgang von Kempelen. Now, it's not that I'm exalting the honorable act of providing employment alone. The case I'm arguing is more expansive than that, and there are 2 points I'm compelled to establish regarding the cheating chess challenger. First, the machine, although it did not function as it claimed to, did have many examples of genius of design at work within it. And not just the access to the mind of its secret astute opponent, but the ingenious way the machine functioned through its workings that enabled the game to be played by the Turk. And it was inspired by magic, which often has misdirection as a key to its success. Sometimes. Yes, most of the grand inner workings that were shown to the crowd before a match were inert. They did nothing more than reinforce the believability of the actual hoax that was about to play out. However, actual mechanics designed by von Kempelen that allowed the Turk to work were indeed ahead of their time. You probably know that until recently, designers of modern robots and prosthetic arms and hands were greatly challenged themselves with how difficult it was to empower a mechanoid or prosthetic limb to accurately locate a small object, and then to gently grasp that object and place it upright with precision elsewhere. Kempelen accomplished this in 1770. Within the Turk's cabinet, a duplicate board that mirrored the upper board was displayed before its hidden chess master, and he then operated the expertly designed levers that deftly moved and enabled the Turk's nimble fingers to meticulously grip and then set the pieces down upon the board before the eyes of its often befuddled opponents. My second reason for vehemently advocating this sham machine is because of the ripples of progress in design and literature we have with us because of it here today. Having encountered some of the finest minds of its time, the machine served as an inspirational jumping-off point. Probably in some ways we won't ever know, but the most striking to note is the fact that Charles Babbage sat opposite the Turk in 1819. He lost, of course, but it is widely thought that just the act of engaging with what he believed was a real, thinking machine caused Babbage to be inspired and doggedly designed the very first computer, what he called the analytical engine, in 1822. In doing so, it was his invention of this rudimentary calculating machine that caused it to become the founding object that gave birth to all of the precursory designs that eventually led to the modern computers present today. It's also proposed across many writings about the Turk, the machine which our Mr. Poe became so unconvinced of during his study of it as an audience member and through his investigations of the history of its time in Europe, that Poe then came up with the idea for one of the first official mystery novels, The Murders in the Rue Morgue. His lead character in the book does the same kind of detective work that Poe engaged in to uncover the Turk in the not-so-murderous crime it was perpetrating. One might even argue that Poe's book then inspired the soon-to-follow onslaught of detective novels and even real-life investigators of actual crimes to be more shrewd and analytical in their methods of investigation, perhaps shaping the profession of private investigation. So I humbly submit to you, my dear guests, that we honor the world-changing advancements that can come from one lovesick Romeo's obsessive mind, and that we should be thankful for what a little clever deception can bring forth in an impactful and positive way in the world. Not everything is meant to be on the up and up. So what became of the tricky Turk? I hear you thinking. Well, after its then-current chess master died, and the game was fairly much up with people knowing the machine was a fake, its shifty showman, Johann Mausel, became a hopeless alcoholic. He didn't even live long enough to see the machine shipped home to Europe, where it was moved around and on display as a curiosity here and there for a few years. Until, unbelievably, some time later, it was purchased by Edgar Allan Poe's physician, Dr. John Mitchell, who donated the Turk to the Chinese Museum in Baltimore. Later, it was sadly burnt to ashes in an all-consuming fire that had spread to the museum on July 5th of 1854. Mitchell, who had raced to the museum in hopes of rescuing the beloved machine, is often quoted to have said that upon attempting to enter the room but found it to be too filled with flames to enter, reported that he could hear the burning Turk exclaiming his only often spoken word,
"Turk, Turk, Turk, Turk,"
during his fiery incineration. Delightful. A beautiful working replica of the Turk can be seen today and was built by John Gunn. It is based on the many books, etchings, and drawings of the original machine. I encourage you to stop by our information desk to gather more information and to research it for further enjoyment on your own. You won't be disappointed. And now, my dear patient guests, a few words about our own mechanical gypsy, Maria, as I know how excited you are to engage with her. As you can see, there is no room for any other person other than Maria inside of her splendid glass case. She has no human helping her to perform. You need only to slip a few coins or folded bills into the ornate escutcheon plate slot to activate her. If she does not move or say anything when you've done this, she's waiting for you to ask her a question. In her diary, it is written that in 1865, a sailor dropped in a few coins and Maria instantly sighed, became sullen, and began to hum a funeral dirge. Her costumed mice began to play the funeral march on their wee violins. The shocked sailor ran from the parlor of the house in a fit of fright. He dashed into the street and was immediately trampled by the huge horses of a funeral cortege. I guess you can make of that whatever you like. My point is, Maria is unpredictable. She may speak or not. She may consult her crystal ball. She may whisper something cryptic that only you will understand. She's also been known to dispense tiny trinkets and baubles from the return coin slot on the front of her cabinet as well. She once expelled a key to a lady who then used it to open a chest that had remained locked in her family's attic for 100 years, which was said to have contained a skeleton in a wedding dress, if you can believe that sort of thing. But I digress. I want to state that we cannot protect you from what may come when you meet with Maria. Ah, well, there is one bit of advice I can freely give you, and I understand how strikingly real she looks, but the open circle cut in the glass in front of Maria's face, it's there to enable you to hear Maria should she choose to speak to you. Do not stick your fingers through the circular opening in an attempt to touch Maria. She bites. I hope you don't mind if I tiptoe past those of you waiting in line. Don't worry, I'll still be able to hear any sobbing or screaming from my little suite of rooms. Thank you so much for visiting, and good luck. I mean, good night. Good night, my dear guests. Well, darling, how was Maria's first performance in 100 years? I thought I heard a bit of a ruckus at times.
To you and I, a raging success. To the guests, iffy at best. Maria predicted a wedding for Dorabelle, who's only been married for a month. She told Mr. Grimsby he would soon visit his mother, who's been dead for 10 years. And when Mr. Perkins asked how his future looked, she said nothing, but did expel a wooden eye into the tray below.
I did warn them. How did we do in takings?
$85 and 3 fingers.
Excellent. The Midnight Library is proudly brought to you by everyone at Astonishing Legends. Our excellent sound design is by Chris and Jason at Sounds Like an Earful. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And I would love to hear from you personally. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/midnightlibrary. And our wonderful but warped merch is available from Redbubble on redbubble.com/people/midnightlibrary.